That's the conguero and percussionist extraordinaire Poncho Sanchez with Afro Blue. That, of course, was a tune made famous by Mongo Santa Maria, another conguero master conguero. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, November the 13th, and much to talk about, so let's get to it. We had a development not too long ago, actually, about an hour or so ago or two, with the House Republicans and their leader, John Boehner, vowing that there will be no immigration reform bill this year, that there will be no action on immigration reform this year, so that any hopes of getting something done just up in smoke. But it's part of a discussion that we need to talk about, especially in the wake of the November 5 elections. And the question, of course, is, will the Democrats be losing Latino love over immigration? To help us with this and other questions, we have our guest, Dr. Luis DeCipio. He's a professor of political science and professor of Chicano and Latino studies at the University of California, Irvine. He has written prolifically on politics generally, but specifically on race, ethnicity, and politics, including his books, Making Americans, Remaking America, Immigration and Immigrant Policy, and Counting on the Latino Vote, Latinos as a New Electorate. Thanks, Luis, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, you've had a chance to go over some of the figures of the November 5, the off-year, as they call it, off-year elections. What is the picture that emerges in your mind?
Well, I think we saw a couple of things. There was support both in New Jersey and in Virginia for the more moderate candidate. And I think that's a lesson probably for the Republicans particularly. But I think we saw sort of a troubling sign in terms of the turnout in both states. We saw the core electorates turning out, and the core electorates tend to be older, tend to be whiter, and tend to be a little bit more conservative. So, you know, to the extent that it's really the off-year election, the election in between the presidential year and the off-year elections, is a harbinger of what's going to happen next year in 2014 when the entire Congress is up for election and a third of the Senate. I think the Democrats should be worried because they are going to have an electorate that is not the electorate that elected President Obama, but an electorate much more like the 2010 cycle that brought in, you know, strong Republican control of the House of Representatives and a strong Tea Party caucus within that House of Representatives Republican caucus.
So if you were to extend your thesis a bit, what would you say should be expected, or what do you reasonably expect to happen in 2014?
Unless there is some issue that can unite and galvanize more progressive elements of the electorate, I think we would expect the Republicans to maintain control of the House of Representatives, not with their current majority, but with a significant enough majority to give Speaker Boehner, you know, comfort going forward. And I think we're going to see a genuine competition for the United States Senate in which the Democrats could lose control of the Senate. My suspicion is that they won't at the moment, but, you know, there are enough races that are up in the air that, you know, that's an open question. The Republicans have very successfully shot themselves in the foot in some Senate races recently, and I suspect they will do that again in 2014, and that will give the Democrats, you know, probably the ability to hold on to the body. That said, you know, this could change if there and a new issue enters the electorate that Democrats are able to create a national vote around that could certainly protect the Senate and maybe seriously cut into the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. I guess the other question for 2014 is which Republican Party comes out dominant. I think people are reading the off-year elections, you know, what happened last week, as sort of a victory for the, you know, the traditional element of the party, the business wing of the party. Certainly we saw that in the Alabama congressional race, definitely saw that with Governor Christie being reelected, and I think to a significant degree I've seen this in the Virginia races, one of which, the Attorney General race, is still up in the air. You know, to the extent that there's this ongoing battle for the soul of the Republican Party, you know, the more interesting outcomes of 2014 will probably be this question of sort of, which is what happens in the primary season. You know, does the Tea Party continue to increase its share of the Republican Party in Congress, or is the sort of mainstream, more business-oriented wing of the party able to keep them under control? That said, even if they keep them under control, the House is moving to the right, you know, even people elected with support of the business wing of the Republican Party know that they have to be very conservative on a series of social issues, or they will face a primary challenge in 2016 or whenever they're up next up for reelection. So anyway, I mean, long-winded story, but I think there will be two important sets of elections in 2014. One will be a series of Republican primaries, and those will start happening in February and continue through early September. And then the second will be what happens in November, and that's, you know, probably ultimately going to be decided by what happens in those Republican primary races.
A particular interest of yours is the conflation between race and ethnicity. Did you notice anything? Was there anything remarkable about the Latino voting bloc and the African-American voting bloc and any other voting bloc in this November 5 election?
Well, I think we saw several things. Let me say I'm always cautious about exit polling in these off-year elections because the networks just don't invest the same level of resources that they do in a presidential race. So we have bigger margins of error, you know, which is a statistical thing. But, you know, the point estimate that we read in the newspaper is not as accurate in an off-year election as it is in a presidential year. But I think several things that we saw. One is that in what turned out to be a much closer race, I think, than people expected, at least in the last couple of weeks of the election, Virginia going Democratic, recognizing that this attorney general race is still, I think, divided by 100 votes at the moment and won't be resolved for a couple of months probably, was only won by the Democrats because of a growth in both the Latino and the Asian American voting blocks over 4 years ago, the last time they had one of these, you know, statewide elections in Virginia that wasn't paired with a presidential race. So Democrats were saved by steady growth in the Latino and Asian American vote in Virginia and the sizable African American vote that the Democrats have always relied on in Virginia, but it didn't seem to grow perceptibly, you know, from 4 years ago. So one very positive story for, you know, sort of the Obama coalition, if you will, you know, strong support from minority communities overcoming defeat in the white community assured Democratic victories in the state of Virginia. In New Jersey, on the other hand, Governor Christie, who, you know, is an incumbent, so obviously had greater, you know, greater name recognition in the state, and at least presents himself on some issues as being somewhat more moderate than the sort of modal point of the Republican Party right now, was able to win a majority of Latino votes. So, you know, here a case where would give some Republicans some optimism, perhaps, for their future with the Latino community. I would suspect that I would read this a little bit differently, instead seeing it as an incumbency advantage for Christie and a pretty low turnout among Latinos in New Jersey. Probably the final interesting outcome that I hadn't really thought about, is worth observing, is that New York's new mayor, who is white, though married to an African American woman, did better among African Americans in the city of New York than did the African American mayor who was elected in 1989. Yeah. Now, you know, admittedly, we're in the, you know, 89% versus 94% range. So, you know, it's really at the tail end of a statistical, you know, outcome. So probably we can say they did the same. But even saying that, I think, is a pretty strong endorsement by New York's African American community for New York's new mayor.
An interesting thing about the Virginia race, though, is that the Democratic candidate had a lot of ammunition. First, I mean, he outspent his opponent, I think, by five times or something like that. And he had heavy hitters. He had the Clintons, and he had the president come to campaign for him, and still just literally squeaked by in victory. So what does that say about the appeal of the Clintons and Obama in Virginia?
Oh, I think it says more about Virginia's governor-elect than it does about either the Clintons or the President Obama. Terry McAuliffe was a weak candidate going in and really got by.
Yeah, they had 40% of the people polled didn't like either the Democratic the Republican candidate.
It was a battle of the lessers, really. Terry McAuliffe has done a lot for the Democratic Party. You know, for those of us that are a little cautious about the role of money in politics, we're suspicious of him, but at the same time, he did his job well. I mean, in an environment that rewards raising money, he knew how to raise money. But he is really more a product of Washington. I mean, he was born in New York State and has lived in Northern Virginia, you know, the suburban Washington area, for years. But his orbit isn't the state of Virginia. His orbit is the power centers of Washington, and I think voters in Virginia had a sense of that. That said, they really disliked the Republican Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, who was his opponent. So you know, Governor-elect McAuliffe's successes, may owe a little bit to it certainly owes a lot to the Clinton connection rather than maybe the Clinton visits. And certainly President Obama did his part as the sitting president in an off-year election. But any weakness in the outcome was McAuliffe's fault. And everybody knew that going in, you know, that he overcame that is, I guess, a tribute to him.
An interesting aspect of that same race, I think, is the performance of the third party candidate.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I think that comes directly out of that result that 40% of Virginia voters just didn't like either the Democrat or the Republican. It was a protest vote, and that's often the role that third party candidates play in American elections, and I think very clearly did so here. So, you know, I would say I haven't seen polling evidence to this effect, but the majority of third-party voters in this case didn't really know anything about the candidate they were voting for. They did know a lot, however, about both Governor-elect McAuliffe and Attorney General Cuccinelli.
Well, we come to this very significant development today with the announcement by John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, that there should be no expectation of anything being passed this year with respect to immigration reform. So what does this mean for this huge Latino bloc that was gathered and providing momentum behind this endeavor?
Well, it will certainly lead to disappointment. Steady growth of the pro-immigration reform movement that does not simply include Latinos and to some degree Asian Americans. I mean, it has brought together the business community. It's brought together leadership of many of the major unions. It's brought together agricultural interests. I mean, it's an amazing coalition in sort of contemporary politics. If we think about it, it cuts across a lot of divides in American politics. They will all be disappointed, I think, with the outcome. That said, I think they've seen the writing on the wall for a while in that their House has simply not been holding the hearings that it would need to hold in order to pass any sort of immigration bill in this calendar year. I think there's a small window for immigration reform early next year, sort of before the Republican primary process heats up, and then more likely in the lame duck session after the midterm elections next year. And, you know, all of the energy that's gone into preparing for a vote this year, the coalition building, evidence gathering, that can all be used quite easily, you know, in either January of 2014 or more likely, as I say, in November and December of 2014. The Senate bill, which is, you know, has been passed by the Senate, is still on the table until Congress adjourns next November or December, whenever it formally adjourns. So, you know, there is the opportunity then for the House if it sees an opportunity to bring the issue to the fore. I think Speaker Boehner generally wants to put immigration behind the Republican Party before the 2016 presidential race. His rank and file, however, aren't with him on that. So if he sees the opportunity, he'll take it. But he's just being told by his membership that they don't want to pay the political price for it. So they'll take a sort of a short-term victory, and then definitely a long-term loss, because the maintenance of immigration as an issue just works to the Democrats' advantage.
But just the same, I mean, the opposition within the House was expected, but is this also a kind of strategic failure on the part of the Democrats, that they didn't really situate themselves well on getting this bill passed? You know, as a kind of strategy play.
Well, I mean, going back to the beginning of the Obama administration, there was a conscious decision to ramp up enforcement, and that has led to the highest level of deportations that the nation has ever seen. On the hope or assumption, I guess it depends on your perspective, that by showing that enforcement could work, that moderate Republicans would come into line. I think the bigger, not strategic failure, but unanticipated outcome was that Speaker Boehner has very weak control over his coalition. I think the assumption was, and we saw this in the initial conversations about the so-called grand bargain, the combination of spending cuts and revenue increases that President Obama and Speaker Boehner were negotiating, Speaker Boehner doesn't control his party coalition. Consequently, he has to yield to cohesive blocks within his coalition, and that blocked the grand bargain. That certainly closed down the government a couple weeks ago, or last month, and now has blocked immigration reform. So, I guess I don't blame the Obama administration as much as I blame Speaker Boehner, really, for not being willing to take a stand against his caucus. The only reason that there isn't an immigration reform vote in the House of Representatives is that Speaker Boehner has chosen to enforce the so-called Hastert rule, the rule that nothing can come to the floor of the House of Representatives unless a majority of the majority caucus, so in the current situation, a majority of the Republican caucus, supports it. Speaker Boehner could certainly get an immigration bill through the House of Representatives with most Democratic votes and the 30 or 40 Republicans who are clearly willing to support some form of immigration reform, not necessarily the Senate bill, but, a more moderate version of the Senate bill. How this will be played in this coalition that has come together to support immigration reform, I don't know. But I think the Obama administration is on pretty strong political footing. The problem is they don't want to be on strong political footing. They want an immigration reform bill. And the Obama administration will face a dilemma next year, in that the program that it designed in 2012 to provide temporary legal status to people who would be eligible for the DREAM Act, young adults who came to the United States as children and have gone on to pursue their education or to serve in the military, that two-year temporary status that was established in 2012 is going to start to expire. I mean, it's 2 years from when you apply, so it will continue to expire into 2015 for many. But anyway, he'll face the challenge of renewing that, which I'm quite confident that he will, but then the question of whether he will find ways to expand it to other segments of the unauthorized immigrant community. And I think there will be a great deal of pressure from the immigrant activist community, from Latino leaders, and maybe even from some of this business coalition that's come together in support of immigration reform, to find administrative ways to establish temporary status for some significant share of the unauthorized immigrant population in the United States. That will be a political challenge for the Obama administration, because it will face a bigger risk that it will become an issue in the 2014 midterms, which again will have a more conservative, older, whiter electorate than the presidential year. I think the administration has shown that it's been pretty deft in designing short-term strategic fixes when Congress has failed to act on immigration.
But, the Democratic Party is also being seen as having too many failures attached to it this year, and people are losing faith. Is there a possibility, for example, going back to that Virginia race, that third parties could begin the process of taking advantage of the discontent people feel for both the Republican and the Democratic parties and build on something new?
There's certainly always that opportunity in American electoral politics. And I think, you know, we've seen it relatively recently with Ralph Nader, with Ross Perot. The challenge that not a third party, but a third party candidate faces is that the bars to enter a national election, you know, the presidential election, a Senate election, and even a congressional election are often quite high. You know, many states establish, you know, very high standards for, you know, petition signatures to get on the ballot. The fundraising is daunting, you know, when you're facing these two juggernauts of the Democrats and Republicans. So where discontent in the electorate, I'm quite sure, will be there in 2014 and 2016, the odds that a nationally galvanizing figure who is not currently a part of the party system will emerge seems very, very unlikely to me. Certainly in a random congressional race here or there, you might, particularly where you have weak candidates, as was the example in Virginia, you might well be able to, you know, elect somebody outside of the Democrats and Republicans. But in terms of something that would come together nationally as a party seems very, very unlikely to me. And in fact, the strength of the Democrats right now, you know, relative to the Republicans, is that they're remarkably cohesive for the Democratic Party, or at least for the Democratic Party that, you know, I've grown up with over the last 40 or 50 years. And it's the Republican division that is blocking them from being all they are is a blocking organization right now. They're not really an affirmative policy party. And that's unfortunate, I think, in the small-D democratic sense of what the nation needs, but it's certainly working to the Democrats' advantage. So, a longer answer probably than you needed, but we will see isolated non-Democrat, non-Republicans being elected, but that coalescing into a party seems very unlikely to me at the moment.
Where are both parties at their weakest now? What is the weakest spot for the Democrats and the weakest spot for the Republicans right now going into 2014?
Well, the weakest spot for the Democrats are what we've been talking about. They've been able to win national elections and actually many statewide election Senate races because they've been able to bring together this sort of newfound coalition between Latinos, African Americans, and Asian Americans, and that those three electorates, it varies obviously by state, vote overwhelmingly for the Democrats, really at unprecedented levels, you know, 70% to 90%. So Democrats need to find a way to maintain that coalition in the absence of President Obama. And President Obama is symbolically important for that coalition, but he was also incredibly, or his people were incredibly smart in terms of building a get-out-the-vote effort that is unprecedented in American politics, at least in the battleground states. I mean, that's always the problem. You know, they do well where they need to and do nothing where they don't need to. Anyway, so Democrats need to maintain that coalition while holding on to a sizable share of, you know, progressive non-Hispanic whites, particularly in urban and suburban areas. That's been their coalition. Where the Republicans are at the greatest weakness of the Republicans is this division over the soul of the Republican Party. One side will ultimately come out dominant, and if it's sort of the mainstream business wing, that will alienate this sort of segment of the Republican electorate that has been, you know, galvanized initially by the Christian right in the early parts of the 2000s, and then by the small government mantra of the Tea Party movement more recently. If it's sort of the Tea Party wing that comes out dominant, at least in a series of elections nationally, then you'll see a movement of the business Republicans to at least voting Democratic regularly, even though they probably won't, you know, formally affiliate with the party. So to answer your question sort of succinctly, I mean, both parties face a question of who their winning coalition is and whether they can hold on to that winning coalition. And most recently in presidential years, the Democratic coalition has been the dominant one, and in off years, in the midterm elections, it's been the Republican coalition, but it's that divided Republican coalition that may not survive.
Well, thanks so much for this this wonderful tour through our most recent election and the implications thereof. And certainly we'll be talking to you again as the situation develops, and we could, you know, see if there's any major change, and if not, if there's even confirmation of what it is you're saying today. But thank you so much, Louis Nisipio, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot. We'll take a break and come back to the SmackDown right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and my goodness, what are the chances that Bill Clinton and Dick Cheney would actually join together in smacking down our dearly beloved president, Barack Obama, and being so openly critical of him? So this SmackDown by Bill Clinton, who still doesn't understand that he's a former president and ought to exercise just plain good manners. Well, we can't say the Clintons have ever had good manners, but to the extent that one understands the need to be diplomatic at a time like this, you do not go public. I mean, that's just basic. You don't go public and excoriate your guy and hold him up to public criticism and ridicule. But you will do it if, in fact, there's a huge reason for it, and that is always money. Wherever the Clintons are, you can bet their first concern is money. So this latest criticism and this specifically significant criticism from President Clinton, who says that it's, you know, basically, let's get this thing changed. If people are losing their insurance policies and coverage under Obamacare, make sure that it doesn't happen. It's basically a direct challenge and a directive to the current president. It's very tacky that a former president would do something like that, more so of the same party. But what it does is it opens the door for wider criticism, and it also is meant to signify that Barack Obama may be president of the United States, but the guy with the competence is Bill Clinton. Look beyond Obama and look toward Clinton for advice. He will show the young boy there, you know, in the way that they use boy in the South. The young boy with no experience, in fact, that was the criticism of the co-president at the time, Hillary Clinton, that Barack Obama was going to be doing on-the-job training. And this was an office that required experience, you know, the kind that she has, Hill and Bill. But it was quite offensive to do something like that, and injurious. As you know, I'm not a card-carrying member of the Barack Obama fan club. But you notice how these things are done. And when it comes to people's interests, everything goes out the window. Here is Barack Obama breaking his butt to raise all kinds of money. He's outshined everybody with raising money to support Democratic candidates, to keep the Democratic Party in cash, to do its strategic ad campaigns. Every day he's someplace raising money for the party. He's done a fantastic job. But Bill Clinton, in one fell swoop, just canceled everything and said, listen, the main thing that you need to know is that I know better than you do what you ought to be doing. And in a way, it's true, because Obamacare, after all, is the product of the Clintons. It started with them in 1993. They didn't have the wherewithal to get it passed. In fact, a lot of lawsuits ensued because, of course, Hillary, in customary fashion, put together this reform plan in secret. And now everybody's talking about, well, the site isn't working well, and this is so bad, and now people are losing their policies and coverage, and now the doctors are even quitting the system, and all kinds of calamities are occurring. And so Mr. Clinton, in good old-fashioned Dixiecrat, the Dixiecrat came out in him and said, now, boy, let me show you how to do this. Let me tell you how you do this, son. This is what you ought to do. He couldn't get it done. But in the sidelines, he can pontificate and even, I mean, set aside all kinds of notions about fidelity and loyalty to the party and all of that stuff. All of that falls by the wayside. This is about serious money, folks. And the Clintons don't play. There's a lot of money here on the line. Let me put it to you this way. Yes, the site isn't working and whatnot, but they were so close. This thing was so close because Barack Obama actually did get the ball in, you know, close to the end zone, even though it was wrong the way they did it, and illegal and unconstitutional. They're still calling it a law. I believe it is not, and we've had explanations as to why it is not legal. Sneaking it in, among other bills, in the dead of night, before people are breaking to go home for the holidays and so forth. All these slimy Chicago, old Chicago-style politics. But he got it into, quote, law, unquote. That was a major step forward for this rotten piece of legislation. But you see, there's so much money in this thing. And this is what the Clintons were after from the beginning. This was to be a big thank you, and of course it would reap dividends down the road, to the insurance industry. Because after all, they helped to write the bill. They helped to write the legislation. And all those thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of regulations were the proof that they locked themselves in for the long haul. And Mr. Obama, being a Harvard grad and surrounded by other Harvard grads, because the Harvard people are very smart, you know. In fact, that was one of the key words of his administration, smart. Hillary Clinton practiced, she said, smart diplomacy. See, until she came along, diplomacy was pretty stupid, but it was smart. And Obama himself talked about smart, a smart way of doing things. So they're very, very smart. And they circumvented the law very smartly, very, very smartly, and thought that, well, okay, it's a free lane straight into the end zone. Let's go. What's holding things up? And then with all the smartness, this, you know, all this stuff starts to happen with the website. And now they're saying it's the website. It's actually the law itself. It's putrid. And in a way, the website malfunctioning is kind of a karmic reward for doing this awful thing that they did by getting this piece of legislation passed the way they did it. But now they can literally taste the money. The insurance companies were so sure that this was going to be a good thing. And many of them hung in there, hoping that this thing would work out, because once it gets moving, it will be like, as the Chinese would call it, an iron rice bowl. It would just be there forever. Money would just keep flowing in over and over for year after year after year, billions and billions of dollars. All they needed was to get people in. They need the numbers. Remember I told you that this is a thing? You need the numbers, and you need qualified kinds of numbers, and they're not getting either of them. They'll get the poor people, but it happens that they're only getting poor people. they're not getting the better off folks to balance them off. Because part of the formula here is you have to get younger, healthier people into the system in massive numbers to offset the cost, presumably, of poorer people who tend to be sicklier. But it's not working. And that is the real scary thing about Obamacare right now. The fish are just not biting. And with that come recriminations. Bill Clinton is so mad that, well, Hillary couldn't get it done. He couldn't get it done. Obama kind of sort of got the real first part of it done, and now he can't get the next part of it done. He's angry. And that public explosion of criticism is really an expression of how desperate they are to get the money rolling. It's really annoying them. How is it that we're so close and we get screwed up now by a website? But of course, it's not a website problem alone. There will be lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, just as it was when Hillary Clinton was writing this thing in secret. Everybody and their grandpappy filed a lawsuit. And then it was so overwhelming that they literally had to shelve the thing because they thought they were so brilliant that they never considered all of the loopholes and the pockets where they left themselves vulnerable. Any competent constitutional lawyer could nail them to the ground on these things. And certainly in the insurance industry, there would be people who have one job and one job only, and that is to look for places within any contract where they are vulnerable. And they're not going to sustain vulnerability at all. They're not going to stand for it. So the Dixiecrat came out in Bill. And we do have the dynamic that had not been really expressed before, but we see the dynamic clearly now. Here is a devoted Clintonite. This president literally owes so much of a favor, he thinks, to the Clintons. And they have no problem smacking him in public, reducing him to the good old Dixiecrat days. Listen here, boy. If you can't do this thing, here's what you have to do. If I have to tell you in public, this is what I'm going to do. Have no problem with that. On the basis of that alone, on the basis of Bill Clinton's comments alone, Barack Obama should just really get mad. Really tap into the dark side, if you know what I mean, and set him straight. But he doesn't have the courage because he's not his own man. This is an owned president. This president has not been making his own decisions from day one. We are clear about that. And yet, there's every reason for him to feel completely confident in doing things his way. And all he had to do all along was to listen to what people say the priorities are. The priority still remains jobs. He's running around trying to make it so clear to the Democratic Party and to the Clintons and to whomever else he thinks he owes allegiance to that he's doing their bidding first. They are the priority. His own constituencies have been, you know, cast aside. We still don't have a jobs program. And you're messing around with something that is a problem. Obamacare, which was Hillary Care, what did they call that? They called it the patient protection. Before it was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, it was basically Hillary Clinton's Health Security Act. But it is loaded with money in mind, just generating money for the insurance industry. And people just happen to be a key factor. The numbers are a key factor in making the system work. And that's the thing that has now blown up in their faces. Even if this were to be working, if everything were to be fixed and this was going to be functioning at peak tomorrow, the law itself is rotten. It's full of contradictions. It's full of all kinds of reasons for all kinds of people to legally challenge it. This is a nightmare, but it's great for lawyers because they'll make a lot of money. The government will have to dispatch a whole cadre of lawyers just to this Obamacare. So I thought I would describe Mr. Clinton's reaction today as a good old Dixiecrat came out at him finally today. And we see how these folks have no hesitation whatsoever. There's no need to observe protocol and good manners and any delicacy or say these things in private, you know, and hash them out. No problem shaming the president in public because his interests, Clinton's interests and Hillary's interests, they see this, quote, failure, unquote, as a block in their way. Had Obamacare, you know, just been successful, certainly successful as opposed to the utter failure that it was under Hillary and Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton would have a wonderful piece of ammunition to launch her presidential campaign with. This is not something she can boast about now, and they will all blame it on Obama. See, here you give this guy something to do, and he can't get it right. This thing needed to work by now, in order, based on timing, in order for Hillary Clinton to have claimed this particular piece of legislation as her victory. Her contribution to the aggregate health of America. She would have been able to claim this as her signature piece of legislation that she began even before she contemplated public office. She was just so concerned. But it's not working, and that's frustrating them. Because what is she going to be running on besides say, well, I was Secretary of State for a hot minute. And even that, when you say Secretary of State, another voice says, Benghazi. it's not going to leave her that easily. This was supposed to have been the jewel in her crown. And what a mess it has turned out to be. And it's all Barack Obama's fault because he just can't get a thing right. And that's what we saw yesterday with Bill Clinton becoming very public because now Hillary's political future is affected, because this thing is, it doesn't look like it's going to be solved anytime soon. And she needs as many things to run on as possible. This is not going to be one of them. And even the Democrats, with Bill Clinton coming public, other Democrats are now coming public. I even saw a couple of African-American Democrats mouthing off, talking about how frustrating it is. They wouldn't have said so until and unless they got permission from the boss. The real president stepped forward and basically cussed out their leader in public and consigned him to the corner, like, you know, for the dunce cap. Put on your dunce cap and go stare in the corner. You don't even know how to get things done right. This is a very profound lesson, by the way, in politics. And it may sound like just a criticism of one president, a former president, about the situation with his, his acolyte. But this is deeply rooted in the racist Dixiecrat South. And you see clearly before you how this is a black and white thing. Here's a white president who has no problems embarrassing a black president. It's never been done. Not even George Bush would do something this tacky and gross. But here's Clinton agreeing with Cheney and Cheney agreeing with Clinton. How about that? So Barack Obama ought to be thinking about the significance of this just about now. He ought to be thinking what this says. The level of contempt that is visited upon him, where nobody feels any compunction about regarding him with any degree of respect, not even a former president like himself. It is, for the president, a reason to go back to the law books and read that famous U.S. Supreme Court decision. The black man has no rights, that the white man need respect. That's a wonderful decision. He needs to read and internalize that, because it came true yesterday. No question about that. We'll be following this up, of course, and other things as we go along for this week, but it was very significant, and it resonated at so many different levels. So many different levels. And we should always remember that this notion of the post-racial society, it doesn't even matter to a former president. He had no problem just piling it on, even though it would have damaged a fellow president, which is really tacky. It would have damaged the party, and it would have damaged the future of the party in upcoming elections, including possibly even his wife's own presidential run. But he was reacting, as I said, on a whole different level, right back to the old Dixiecrat South, the old slavocracy. And that, even at the presidential level, that is the level of conduct that you see in a person who's supposed to be far more sophisticated than that. But every now and then, they slip up and show themselves for exactly what they are. The Dixiecrat par excellence in fine form yesterday. Well, we've come to the end of our program today. I just hope that it meant something. We'll continue the discussion tomorrow and, of course, Friday. And you never know, some really interesting things are coming your way, but I can't say, because the element of surprise is very, very important. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You want to write me if you can. I always try to answer as promptly as I can at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, plural, at gmail.com, and on the Facebook page at Lead Stories with your Trace Lead. Thanks a lot, and watch how this thing unfolds. The old Dixiecrat has shown himself. Take care.